I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Last night's presidential debate has been pretty much chewed over, but one exchange left us with questions. Republican John McCain said he would order the U.S. Treasury to buy $300 billion in troubled mortgages and replace them with more affordable loans. The Obama campaign responded, that's already in the bailout bill. Well, it turns out John McCain used one word that is new. He said he would order the Treasury to buy up troubled mortgages and replace them with more affordable loans. The bailout bill passed by Congress last week allows the Treasury to buy mortgages directly, but doesn't require it. In an op-ed last month, Senator Hillary Clinton pushed the same idea the bailout now offers, reaching back to a Depression-era New Deal agency to call for a new homeowners loan corporation to help homeowners refinance their mortgages. Well, how about selling new mortgages the way banks once did, by seriously screening people for their ability to pay? Much anger and blame is being thrown around at wealthy Wall Street CEOs who drove companies to the ground on what Tim Dwyer of the New York Times calls a system of agreed-upon hallucinations. We'll talk about CEO salaries in a moment. But there's also anger at home buyers who got in over their heads, in particular through low-income housing programs. But there are housing assistance programs that do better screening than some banks and mortgage companies do. Let's take a look at one today. It's named after the biblical prophet Nehemiah, who rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem. In partnership with other grassroots groups, churches, and governments, Nehemiah has built almost 6,000 homes in Brooklyn, the Bronx, Washington, D.C., and Baltimore. For instance, a resident of Baltimore making $30,000 who qualifies for the program can buy a new or renovated two-bedroom, two-bath row house with a dishwasher and full basement. And the Nehemiah program has an unheard-of near-zero foreclosure rate. How do they do it? Arnie Graf is on the national staff of the Industrial Areas Foundation. That's the largest network of community organizations in the country. He helps run the Nehemiah Project in Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. Arnie, welcome.
Thank you.
And Nikita Lewis, who grew up in Baltimore and now lives in a Nehemiah Project home in that city. She's in her 20s, works as a counselor for troubled youth, makes $49,000 a year in that government job, and has lived in her new home for about 2 to 3 years now. Nikita, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Arnie Graf, let's start with you. We understand the way Nehemiah works. It's sort of a partnership of churches that raise some money, the government that helps out by getting some low-interest loans, banks, a screening that you do with the candidates, and down payments are one of the most important keys that you require. But start by telling us about this partnership. How did you pull this together?
Well, first, the Industrial Areas Foundation assists in building an organization in the city. So mm-hmm. here it's BUILD. Mm-hmm. And that's an organization made up of 40 congregations. The 40 congregations get together and work on various issues. The issues in Brooklyn and here were blight and the rebuilding of blighted communities.
So your organizations find other organizations that want to rebuild blighted areas. But then where do you get the money to do this?
The congregations, we raised in Baltimore a $2.5 million no-interest construction loan fund.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go to build, there's no cost for borrowing money for the construction fund.
Right. Where do you get the money for the loans?
The loans, we negotiated with the state of Maryland and obviously in Brooklyn and New York to provide below market financing for the first mortgage. And we negotiate with the city to provide a $10,000 soft second mortgage that expires at the end of 10 years if the person stays in their home more than 10 years.
Well, let's pick up on that. So they have to get their first mortgage themselves. These people, these candidates have to qualify. But then you also have negotiated these soft loans, $10,000, which would lop $10,000 right off their first mortgage. And if they leave the homes, if they go into foreclosure, they have to pay that $10,000. But if they stay for 10 years, they don't.
That's right.
Right. What are your requirements of them?
People have to make down payments, and when they go to the bank, they have to go through the very conventional way that anybody else normally would have to go through it. So we often, you know, have to work with people. This wasn't the case with Nikita, but for some people, you have to work with them a very long time to get them to figure out how they're going to clean up their credit. Otherwise, they won't qualify for the mortgage. Some people owe a lot of money to hospitals, for example, because they don't have health insurance, so they wind up in the emergency room. So we're very, it's interesting because when people think of working people owning a home, they think of it as, oh, well, those are those liberals. Actually, we're the conservatives. And the conservatives were the ones who were trying to push all kinds of loans on people they couldn't afford.
So we've heard the stories of mortgage sellers telling prospective buyers, oh, you know, you can lie about how much you make, or we don't care if you have that bad credit, and you don't have to put down a down payment, and we can renegotiate all this later. No, you're saying that the people who bought into the Nehemiah projects had to go through, in fact, sounds like tougher screening than maybe some other people.
Exactly. And I think Nikita has a great story on that, and she'll tell you that in a moment. The reason that we don't have foreclosures at this point is because people got into a mortgage in which they knew that they could afford.
And by the way, we can understand the screening and making people go to counselors and clean up their credit and ensuring that they go into a mortgage squeaky clean. But why the down payment? Why was that important to you?
Because if people don't put in some of their own money, then you haven't invested yourself. It's almost like you're renting in your mentality. Mm. And what we try to do is build community as best we can. And Nikita can tell you, I mean, her block is very nice.
Well, Nikita Lewis, again, you know, in your 20s, and now here you are living in a home that you're paying into. You own it. What did you have to do to qualify for the Nehemiah home?
Well, actually, you have to put in an application. Once you put in an application, someone will give you a call from Nehemiah. They let you know that you have to go through several classes in reference to credit, in reference to how to take care of your home, in reference to how to build up your community, and also in order to apply for the government loans, you have to go through a separate set of classes as well, just to make sure that you understand the process, you understand what you can and cannot afford, and you have to be realistic about what you can and cannot afford, because prior to coming to Nehemiah and Build, I went to another builder along with another mortgage company, and they looked at my credit. I have excellent credit, and they looked at what I made. So they were telling me, oh, you can afford $1,355 for mortgage. But when I actually sat back and looked at my other living expenses in addition to the mortgage, that wasn't doable for me.
So let's remind ourselves. We said you made about $49,000 in your government job. And what was this other, sounds like a loan shark, what was this other mortgage company telling you to do?
They were telling me that I can afford a particular mortgage over $1,000, like $1,355, I wanted to say.
A month.
Right. And looking at my student loans that I have to pay back, of course, credit card bills, I couldn't do that because, you know, you have to save. You have to pay other things, bills, gas, electric, food, things like that. And if I would pay $1,355 for a mortgage, it just wasn't doable for me.
By the way, how much pressure did they put on you? I mean, what did this other mortgage company say to you? Did they try to talk you into it?
Oh, they put a lot of pressure on you. It's a sales technique. They keep telling you you can do it. They're looking at credit. They would tell you ways and how you can space the payment out throughout the month, how you can actually afford it. They tell you stories about they just sold a loan to a particular family, and they keep telling you how you can do it. They constantly call you. They would try to work the numbers a different way. They try to give you a different interest rate, which may be slightly lower, or give you a second mortgage. They will tell you what you want to hear. And if you really want that home, knowing in your heart that you can't afford it, if you hear someone else say you can do it and they have a payment plan set out for you, you're going to be gullible and say, okay, well, I can't do this. Let me just get that home. But in reality, you have to look at just the whole package. Can I live on this income and be able to pay this mortgage?
How much did you have to put down on your house?
It varies. For me, it was $1,500, which is, to me, is cheap compared to the other mortgage company that I went to. They wanted me to put between $10,000 to $15,000.
Uh-huh.
And
so they did want
that
more.
That was also a new home.
How does it feel that you've put down a deposit on the home? I mean, how do you feel about your home?
I love my home. It's new. I know that I couldn't live anywhere else in America for the mortgage that I have. It's something affordable. I feel proud. I feel like I have a piece of the American dream, which you struggle to get. I just feel really blessed to be able to get into a property which is funded through Nehemiah, Build, and various churches in Baltimore City.
Well, Arnie, we asked a housing advocate, Bruce Marks, about your organization, and he cautioned against, first of all, demonizing programs that don't require a down payment. His group doesn't, the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation, and he says they also have a low foreclosure rate, but it's because the element that you do both have in common is that you screen people, work with them, counsel them, require them to take courses before they even go to the bank. And I'm just wondering, how important is that?
I think it's very important. In fact, we've had homeowners, the original Nehemiahs, which were in Brooklyn, we suggested $2,500 as a down payment, and the people in the community came together and decided on their own, without us, that it should be $5,000. And they did that on their own, and they did it because they felt like if people didn't have to figure out how to save some of their own money and get into the home, they wouldn't have the same amount of pride, and they wouldn't have the same sense of ownership.
In fact, we understand that in Brooklyn, as you said, the original Nehemiah Project, they felt that they had to resist government attempts to waive down payments. That
That's right.
This was something that
exactly.
You know, they had to go around the government to make it a requirement.
Right. It's a very odd situation to be put in.
Yeah. And Nikita, before we let you go, I know you got to go to work. What do you say to people who have been blaming the huge financial crisis on low-income people who might have stretched beyond their means to take a mortgage that was too big for them? You just explained the pressure, but, you know, here you are in another program. So how do you respond to that?
I think that I wouldn't necessarily blame it on the low-income people. I think overall the mortgage companies and the banks, they know what people can and cannot afford. They are a financial institution. I mean, part of it is, I would say 50-50, the financial institutions as well as the people who are getting into the loan. You know what you can and cannot afford. You cannot succumb to peer pressure or pressure to get this loan. You have to be truthful to yourself. If you know you can't afford that loan and you're looking at what you make at the current time, not what you can make, you have to say no.
Well, Arnie, you know, I'm thinking, too, that some of the highest foreclosures are in places like Nevada, Arizona, and in gated communities, gated developments.
Right.
Your thoughts?
Well, people got over their head.
Low income and high income.
Exactly. And, you know, they got talked into it the same way that, you know, Nikita was saying that her initial bank or mortgage company was, you know, trying to tell her how you can do this and how you can do that. So I think the stigma on working people, low-income people, is really terribly unfair because, like you said, in these gated communities, they're getting foreclosed, you know, $550,000 homes and all of that. So we're trying to rebuild these communities. If we talk people into stuff like that, then people leave in a year, we have the same blight. So, and we're not trying to make a profit.
So as you say, you're just doing what banks used to do, which is
exactly.
Sell a
That's
loan
right.
And make sure you collect on it. And maybe everything old is new again now. Arnie Graff, he coordinates the Nehemiah Housing Program in Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. We also spoke to Nikita Lewis, a Nehemiah homeowner who's got to go to work. So I want to thank both of you.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, just ahead, the other end of the financial spectrum. Take a look at CEO pay. That's in a minute, here and now. A Vanity Fair contributor is saying that as Wall Street giant Lehman Brothers collapsed and went into bankruptcy in September, CEO Richard Fuld was working out on a treadmill in the company's executive gym when an employee who saw Fuld walk over and decked him. CEOs have become a punching bag in Congress as well. Former AIG CEO Martin Sullivan was grilled yesterday for urging the company's board to approve cash bonuses for 70 top executives last March, even as its accounting firm was warning him that the company was at risk. The firm ultimately posted a $5 billion loss in the final quarter of 2007. And on Monday, during the House Oversight Committee hearing on Lehman Brothers, we learned that just days before that company filed for bankruptcy, it gave out $20 million in special payments for three outgoing executives, even though Lehman's money management arm recommended that senior managers give up their bonuses this year. When House Oversight Committee Chair Henry Waxman asked CEO Richard Fuld about his reported $500 million salary, Fuld replied, "The number isn't accurate. I believe it was a little less than $250 million. Still a large number, though," Fuld said. you think? Paul Hodgson is the Senior Research Associate at the Corporate Library, a governance research organization. Paul, Fuld said that his pay was set by an independent compensation committee, which he said aligned executive interests with shareholder interests. But is there a problem, first of all, with these committees? The board appoints the committee, and often the CEO is on the board. Is it a little too cozy at the top?
I think that there is certainly still something of the gentleman's club about the boardroom. But one of the ways of trying to undo that problem is to allow shareholders access to the proxy statement so that they can nominate their own directors instead of only electing or voting for the slate of directors that management has nominated. And the SEC has been stalling on that for the last 2 or 3 years, in fact. When they made some amendments to the bill that went before the House, this was probably about 10 days ago, that was part of the governance changes that were going to be mandated by the bill. But unfortunately, when it got to the Senate and when it went back to the House again, that provision was dropped. So, you know, that piece has been taken out. But it would be a very effective piece of governance because shareholders, who significant shareholders in a company, have a very great vested interest in making sure that that company does not fail. Therefore, if they had a director on the board who could directly represent their interests, which after all is what all directors are supposed to do, then they would be able to have more, at least indirect, influence on what's going on at the company, even making decisions about compensation policies. Our problem with some of the decisions that are made by these compensation committees is that although they, on paper, make great efforts to align executive interests with shareholders by awarding large amounts of stock, the problem is that too much of the stock is time vestings. In other words, all you have to do is turn up for work every day, and over a period of 3 to 5 years, you'll receive all of the stock, rather than, you know, the compensation committee insisting that executives meet specific performance targets in the long term to be able to receive that stock.
Well, let's talk about the stock for a second, because the thinking is that being given stock as compensation will drive a CEO to make sure the company does well, because then his stock rises.
Right, but also you have a situation whereby actions are taken which drive stock prices higher, rather inflating them rather than actually creating long-term sustainable value. So if you overcompensate in stock, then you begin to reverse the beneficial effect of compensating in stock.
Right. If anything is tied to performance, salaries, bonuses, anything, doesn't that incentivize CEOs to take too many risks or, as you say, to inflate the profits?
Well, the problem with many of the financial services companies and the Wall Street firms in particular was that too much compensation was tied to short-term achievements. So, you know, you're measuring performance over 12 months at the maximum. So you have boosted earnings, boosted revenues, boosted net income. We've had record year after record year after record year. And, you know, during this period, there were decisions being made by the board that were encouraging executives to take too risky behavior. And we've seen this play out.
How do you explain that different CEOs were advised by advisory committees, by accounting firms, you're in trouble, pull back on this, how about just holding off on bonuses for a while because that's not going to look good, and they didn't? Is that hubris, or were CEOs just way too tied to commitments they'd made to executives?
It's difficult to say what the motivation is behind this. I mean, I'm just doing some work on a pay survey that we're going to publish, and I was looking at the Fortune 50 just yesterday, and of course, at the end of 2007, both AIG and Lehman Brothers were part of the Fortune 50. And, you know, both of the CEOs of those two companies were amongst the most highly paid CEOs in the country last year. Sullivan earned around $45 million, almost entirely from a substantial short-term cash incentive bonus. And Richard Fuld earned over $70 million last year. So you begin to wonder what it is about a company's performance that can generate incentive payments like that at the same time as internally the finances are crumbling.
Well, the bailout bill has a provision that's aimed at curbing executive pay by barring these incentives we've been talking about for unnecessary and excessive risks. But who judges what's unnecessary and excessive? You've been quoted as saying that it's a very noble goal, but administering it is going to be difficult to impossible.
Well, currently, the Treasury Department and the Treasury Secretary are on the firing line for that one. They're the ones who are going to have to make decisions about that. It would seem to me that the Treasury Department and the Treasury Secretary have got enough on their plate without having to make decisions about what is and isn't inappropriate and excessive risk-taking. You know, what we're really talking about here is short-term actions that do not lead to long-term growth. If you have your eyes set on the short term over a 12-month period to hit an earnings target, to hit a revenue target, or whatever, then you're not necessarily thinking, and you're certainly not being incentivized to think about long-term shareholder value growth, and that's what shareholders are in.
One last quick question. There are a lot of people obviously furious about CEO salaries, especially as companies failed. But what do you say to those who just find it distasteful in a free market economy for government to interfere with salaries?
Well, it's not the first time governments interfered in pay. You know, back in 2003, when the government bailed out the airline industry, the nine largest carriers were required to limit compensation to the salary that had been paid in the previous year. So there were no incentives. There were no additional compensation. And for there was some concern at the beginning of this process that this limit on pay, if it works, would actually discourage executives from signing up to get relief under the act. Well, it didn't discourage any of the airlines from getting relief from the government back in 2003, and I very much doubt that it will, you know, prevent any of the executives from signing up for relief under the act today.
That's Paul Hodgson with the Corporate Library, and we'll be back after the news here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The British newspaper The Independent reports this week that secret executions are being carried out in the prisons run by the Iraqi government. There is no public record of these hangings, but the newspaper says there have been hundreds since Iraq's new government was established. Those executions are taking place in the same cramped cell where Saddam Hussein was executed in December 2006. Well, a new documentary looks back at the trial that led to Saddam's execution and casts doubt on whether he got a fair trial. According to the film, the Iraqi government removed judges they thought were sympathetic to Saddam Hussein, including one judge just days before Saddam was sentenced. The trial of Saddam Hussein airs on PBS Sunday night. Producers Dan Polin and Elise Steinberg join us with more. But before we start, we want to ask the question of whether or not a fair trial was even possible. There was the fog of war. The oppressed majority was coming to power. They were getting to try, finally, the oppressor. Here's former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. He was part of Saddam Hussein's defense team. In the film, he tells you the trial was pure revenge by the new Iraqi government. I want you to comment, but let's listen first.
The demonization has been so intense. So how do you get impartiality? How do you get a fair trial?
What Ramsey is talking about is the charges for which Saddam was tried first and for which he was executed in the end, which was his response to the assassination attempt by members of a Shiite political party in Jujail in 1982. The fact is the decision could have been made to try him for another crime. One of the people we interviewed suggested that Saddam be tried for the executions of his sons-in-law. And that would have changed the political geometry that was operating in Iraq at the time.
There would have been a less of the provoking of the Shia-Sunni conflict. Well, let's remind ourselves about the first trial. There had been a failed assassination attempt on Saddam Hussein by the Shia party, the Dawah. His security forces responded by killing more than 100 villagers. And when the trial started in 2005, years later, the Dawah party was in charge of Iraq's government. So, of course, there has to be some feeling of revenge.
Many of the defense lawyers said the appearance was that this looked like the Dawah party exacting revenge on Saddam Hussein.
Then it gets more complicated, as you show in your film, because we have all these players. And one was Ahmed Shalabi. We remember the Iraqi exile who lobbied in the first place for the U.S. invasion of Iraq, was then placed in charge of the De-Baathification Commission, the commission that was to remove Ba'ath party members from the government after Saddam fell. And the new Iraqi government thought the man investigating Jujail had connections to the Ba'ath Party, so they try to remove him. In the film, Chalabi defends this action. Let's listen.
Anybody associated with the Ba'ath Party cannot take any position or a job with this court, even as a driver.
This, you know, brings the question, why didn't the U.S. Justice Department and, you know, officials who were trying to, you know, help the Iraqis navigate this, why didn't they stand up to them more?
The Americans from the U.S. Department of Justice did stand up and did not allow Judge Rajuhi to be removed from the case.
Well, and in fact, they said they were drawing a line in the sand on that, but it seems as if that was the last line in the sand they drew. From then on, the Iraqi government seemed to have more influence on the trial.
As the violence started to increase and America's power and prestige started to deteriorate. They just simply didn't have the power that they had had at an earlier stage to sort of fight these battles.
Let's remind ourselves, this was 2005, then 2006. Sunni insurgents bombed the Shia mosque in Samarra. It looked like Iraq was spinning into civil war. And Saddam Hussein seized on the insurgency in his defense. William Wiley was a Canadian assigned to Saddam's defense. He says Saddam Hussein told his lawyers to mount a political defense. Let's listen.
I didn't ask him what he meant by that, but I'm quite certain what was meant by that was that the war and the occupation were illegal, the tribunal was unlawful, and Saddam was the rightful president of Iraq. I don't believe it was ethical to do that, but in any event, they did it.
Ramsey Clark echoed what Bill Wiley said when he said Saddam saw this as a political event in which he might actually be able to negotiate his release.
Well, either way, it was a dangerous job for these defense lawyers. Three were murdered. Eventually, Saddam is found guilty in the Dujail case, sentenced to death. We've seen the official video of Saddam's execution, but it doesn't show the actual hanging. Your film includes a second video, a cell phone video with sound that does show the execution. We're not going to play it. You can hear Saddam being taunted by witnesses. You know, describe the scene, Dan.
Saddam responds to somebody who says, to hell with you, or something like that. You mean the hell that is Iraq? And then he says a prayer and is hanged.
I think one of the most tragic things that came out of the cell phone video is that Saddam appears sympathetic, executed in this manner. You know, he became a martyr.
Well, Kanan Makia, who's founder of the Iraq Memory Foundation and was formed to document the abuses under Saddam Hussein's regime, he's an Iraqi, but not a fan of Saddam Hussein's by any means. He had this to say about the execution.
If the government's authority did not extend into the room in which the dictator was going to be executed, what does that say about the government? A mob greeted him there, and the execution was proof positive that the new Shiite political class had failed Iraq.
It's sort of what you've both been saying, that the trial actually became a metaphor for the unraveling of the country that we saw afterwards.
Many people worked to try and make this trial fair. And what you saw was that vengeance won over.
Very, very compelling material. But what's been the impact of the trial? I mean, how do Iraqis frame the trial and the execution? Or is it already, you know, in their past?
Iraqis have different opinions. You know, you have Iraqis who are, this is the last thing on their minds. But on the other hand, you talk to Iraqis who have been victims of Saddam, there was a sense that Saddam got as fair a trial as could be. It wasn't up to Western standards, but he got a fair trial.
And Dan, now, you know, you're showing this your film here. I'm wondering, when you have conversations with friends, do you have trouble getting Americans in particular to care about this? You know, you talk about someone being demonized. Saddam Hussein was presented to Americans as a murderous dictator who gassed his own people.
I think the failure of the Shiite political class is of concern to Americans today because it's these people who we are hoping can bring Iraq together and move it forward to the next step. So it is relevant even to the presidential campaign that's going on now, even though the economy has become a more significant campaign issue.
Yeah, sure, because the debate previously and will be again, not whether or not the surge worked, but whether or not there can be a political solution after the military surge. And so far, you know, the answer has been no. And maybe the roots of that are just, you know, in looking at this trial.
You know, we're hearing in the debates about we're winning the war in Iraq, we're winning the war in Iraq. And I do think that it's important for Americans to view this film and to understand the political situation right now of Maliki's government, the government that, you know, if we pull out, will be there. And I understand that, obviously, with the economy right now, there are a lot of major concerns. But we're in Iraq and we're going to have choices to make.
Lee Steinberg and Dan Polin are co-producers of the film The Trial of Saddam Hussein, airing on PBS this Sunday night. Elise and Dan, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you, Robin.
And taking a second for a quick reminder, you know you can always download a podcast of Here and Now. Take us with you wherever you go. Just go to here-now.org. And before we go today, a look at the mud that's being slung. You're listening to Here and Now. Afghan refugees in northwest Pakistan are begging for bus fare and rides back to Afghanistan. Pakistan told 50,000 Afghans to leave the region, accusing them of links to militants who use the remote area as a base for launching attacks in both countries. The road to the Afghan border through Pakistan's northwest frontier province is quite possibly one of the most dangerous stretches of highways in the world. And if you're traveling there, local people might encourage you to take along some extra insurance. Reporter Will Everett was recently in the provincial capital of Peshawar, where he met a street vendor selling just what he needed, Lucky Smoke.
Just on the outskirts of Peshawar, the Board Bazaar is a scene of pandemonium. Travelers squeeze into gaudily painted buses as huge convoys of diesel rigs rumble past in a smoky haze. Everyone here is headed to the Afghan border 40 miles away. The highway runs through the tribal area, where militant activities have stepped up over the past several months. No one seems exactly afraid, but everyone knows that on this highway, anything can happen. In the distance, there's a small boy with a smoking tin can fastened to the end of a long stick. He darts up to an idling taxi, holds the can up to the open window, and blows the smoke inside. The driver gives him a coin and drives away. As I approach the boy to ask what he's doing, he mistakes my long black microphone for a gun and runs away in tears, bringing laughter from those standing nearby. Later in the morning, I meet Yusuf, a man of about 30, who's also approaching vehicles with a smoking tin can. He doesn't run away from my microphone. Instead, he agrees to smoke me. He takes some seeds from a bag and sprinkles them over the red-hot coals inside the tin can. Then he walks around me, holding the can low to the ground so that the smoke spirals upward like enfolding arms. This is an age-old ritual called spilané. According to folk legend, anything that comes into contact with the smoke receives the protective power of the spilané seeds, an herb used in incense. Yusuf has been doing this on and off since he was a teenager.
I have no other means of making a living. Whenever I get a job, I get fired. So this is what I do. My only other option is to become a thief.
Spilané has its roots in Pakistan's pre-Muslim past. When Silk Road caravans would pass through the area, wandering shamans would offer the smoke to traders to protect them from bandits. Today, travelers face similar dangers. But spilané carries over into any area of life where people feel they need good luck.
It's a spiritual thing. People believe if they buy a new car or open a new shop or a new house, they should first smoke it. That way the car isn't in an accident or the house doesn't burn down. The smoke protects them.
Later, Yusuf approaches a battered Mercedes stopped on the roadside. The driver, Salem, is driving to Kabul today. He says that he always gets the spilané treatment before going through dangerous country.
I will be safe from any bad thing later on.
Yeah.
Because of this smoke. So this is a traditional smoke.
You believe this works?
Yeah.
Do you have proof? I mean, have you
seen
it work?
Yeah, I have seen my parents, my elders to do that. So I'm just sticking with this same tradition.
How much did he charge you?
Nothing. Basically, they are just roaming around, and whatever you want, you can give them. They are not charging anything.
Did you give him anything?
10 rupees.
10 rupees?
Yeah.
It's not much, about 8 cents. Yusuf usually makes around 150 or 200 rupees a day, or $2 or $3. Sometimes he gets lucky himself.
A few days ago, two women stopped me to have their car smoked. They were going to be driving in a dangerous area and wanted protection. So I smoked their car and they gave me 200 rupees.
I ask him if he ever considers giving himself the spilané treatment. It's something he's never considered. Smiling, he drops a few spilané seeds into the can, lets the smoke wrap around his body, and sets off into the noontime traffic, looking for more business.
Reporter Will Everett in Peshawar, Pakistan. His report came to us by way of World Vision Radio and the Public Radio Exchange. Back in a minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
While much attention has been on the presidential campaign, 35 U.S. Senate seats are also up for grabs. 23 Republican and 12 Democrats are facing challenges, and Democrats are projected to pick up at least 5 new seats, giving them a 54-seat majority in the Senate. But a race could turn on a dime. Or a bad ad. As the races get tighter, things are getting nastier on the campaign trail and on the airwaves. Here now, media analyst and Boston University professor of mass communication, John Carroll, has been slogging through it all. He joins us. Welcome.
Thanks, Robin.
Quick note to start. Last week, you talked about fact-checking websites. We urge our listeners to go to them to check the content of what you're about to hear. But you're here to talk about tone.
Right. This is the phase of the race where they turn into real Donnybrooks. And the tighter they are, the more desperate the tactics get, it seems, and the more negative the tactics get. And what you have in many of these races is sort of a war of attrition. Basically, you're trying to drive up your opponent's negatives. And in the process, you're going to drive up your own negatives. So the question is, how do you calibrate it so that you drive up the opponent's negatives more than your own? Because
right.
what you basically want to do is suppress turnout and hope that your people turn out in greater numbers than the opponent's.
Well, let's start in our own backyard. Just north of us in New Hampshire, the Wall Street Journal editorial board recently said that the Senate race there may be the most important in the country. This is Republican John Sununu facing Democratic challenger and former governor Jeanne Shaheen. Here's an ad produced by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce slamming Governor Shaheen, so it's in support of John Sununu. And they're slamming Governor Shaheen on taxes. Now, the video looks like an old-time newsreel, has shots of car crashes and train crashes and other disasters.
Then Shaheen signed a second statewide property tax. Later, Shaheen proposed a sales tax and raised taxes on skiing, movies, fishing.
And again, that's an ad against Governor Jeanne Shaheen. But here's one that her party and the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee came out with recently against Sununu.
It's getting harder for the middle class, and John Sununu doesn't even see it. We have 130,000 people without health care, and Sununu opposed more affordable drugs from Canada. We can't afford to heat our homes, and 7 times Sununu has voted against federal heating assistance.
John, these aren't really, you know, as even as personal as we're hearing the attacks in the presidential campaign.
No, they're not. And actually, the one, the anti-Sununu ad, is pretty mild by the standards of this campaign. There are other ones that are tougher on Jeanne Shaheen, but I think the message that they're trying to get out is a twofold message. One, she's a taxing machine, and the bookend to that is she's got all these spending schemes. Jeanne Shaheen's and the Democrats are trying to paint John Sununu as somebody who's out of touch, who's in lockstep with the Bush administration, and who's acting in his own interest.
So this is attack ad 101, if you will. These are just ads that attack the other candidate instead of boosting the candidate of the party.
Right. I mean, basically what you want to do is make your opponent unelectable. And so you want to say there's no way you should be voting for this guy because this guy doesn't have your interest at heart.
Well, let's go to attack ad 102, if you will, that gets a little more personal. And it's with another important race to watch, which is in North Carolina. Now, the pundits there are calling this a toss-up. You have incumbent Republican Senator Elizabeth Dole facing State Senator Kay Hagan. A recent ad has two elderly gentlemen rocking on the porch of a general store. This is sponsored by the Democratic Senatorial Campaign, and they are talking about Elizabeth Dole. Let's listen.
I'm telling you, Liddy Dole is 93.
93?
Yep. She ranks 93rd in effectiveness.
After 40 years in Washington?
After 40 years in Washington, Dole is 93rd in effectiveness, right near the bottom.
Okay, never mind that one of them sounds like he's from Maine, not North Carolina. Obviously, they're going at her record, but of course, are they going at age?
I think that's the subtext of it. It's two old guys sitting in rocking chairs, so I think they're trying to form a nifty little triangle here. It's interesting that the Democrats are spending $8 million against Elizabeth Dole. They see a real vulnerability there.
Well, Elizabeth Dole fired back with an ad of her own. It features this little yapping dog jumping up against a fence as if trying to see someone on the other side of the fence. Let's listen.
They call her Fibber K. Hagen. Fib after fib, she tries to turn us against Elizabeth Dole. But we know Elizabeth has been consistently voted one of the 10 most admired women in the world.
Here, Elizabeth Dole is, you know, pretty much calling her challenger a dog.
Well, yeah. I mean, at least there's no lipstick involved, so that that really helps. But I want to know who they are. They call her Fibber K. Hagen. I mean, is that just the people around Elizabeth Dole? I mean, you never know who they are. But the idea is that she's someone unreliable. Elizabeth Dole is a known quantity. Not only that, she's almost a national resource.
So voters there are going to have to determine if that's in fact true, if they feel that Elizabeth Dole has delivered for them or maybe has, you know, been around too long. Dust will settle on Election Day on that one. The final Senate race we want to look at is perhaps one of the nastiest. It's in Minnesota, where comedian turned political commentator Al Franken is taking on first-term incumbent Norm Coleman. Now, according to the website opensecrets.org, this is the most expensive Senate race in the country, about $30 million raised. And Franken has focused on linking Coleman to Republican Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska, who, as we well know, is facing corruption charges for allegedly accepting gifts. Now, here's a Franken ad where the main character is a talking fish.
Over 10,000 lakes in Minnesota, but where does Norm Coleman go fishing? Alaska. Indicted Alaska Senator Ted Stevens flew him up and got big oil honchos to give thousands just to fish with Norm.
Then John Carroll, you know, it's got a talking fish, and you could do this ad as a very straightforward, you know, I'm concerned that my challenger is associated with a lawmaker who's under investigation. But again, we're talking about tone.
Well, I think it cuts through the clutter. Think about the average break on local television these days when you're having these barrage of ads on 60 Minutes. In the Boston market, there was an anti-Shaheen ad, an anti-Sununu ad, an anti-Shaheen ad, and then a promo for The Amazing Race. And I mean, that was the entire break. So this is happening in Senate races all across the country. So I think the ability to break through and to somehow have something that visually grabs people is probably one of the biggest challenges that they have.
Well, the Republicans took that on. They portrayed Al Franken as angry and unstable. This ad from the GOP Senatorial Committee goes back to Franken's career as a writer for Saturday Night Live.
Is Al Franken fit for office? Franken writes about committing rape, writes pornography so vile Democrats denounced him. His profanity laced anger followed by violent outbursts.
Now again, go to our website, here-now.org. We'll link you up with some fact checks, apparently some references there to skits that were written in the 90s or even not even written but maybe proposed. But still, you know, does something like that come through? That had a very serious tone to it.
It certainly did, and it was basically a character attack on Al Franken. And his baggage is perhaps even more onerous than a record as a governor of a state, because his baggage is so easy to
unpack.
Exactly, to unpack, and it's so hard for him to carry around because there's so much of it, and it's so open to interpretation.
But, you know, overall, is there some sort of way of tracking how do negative ads work? I mean, do they work well in the final analysis?
People tend to believe negative things about people more readily than positive. The drawback is that they can backfire on you, that you can basically become victim of backlash, and you can become an unsympathetic character to the voters, so that this side of you is something that the voters may not want to see. That's why you're seeing a lot of this kind of dirty work handled by independent outside political groups, the Democratic campaign committees, the Republican campaign committees, MoveOn.org, the Chamber of Commerce. All of them are going in there to try to distance the candidates themselves so that they don't get this sort of backsplash on them.
Because no one likes to get mud on their clothes.
Right. I mean, somebody's got to pay the dry cleaning bill, right?
John Carroll, Boston University professor of mass communication, Here and Now media analyst, speaking about some of the nasty senatorial races going on around the country. John, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.